Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 306, recorded Monday, July 17th, 2017. Bad choices. Triangulation is brought to you by WordPress. WordPress powers 28% of all the websites, including mine. Get 15% off your new website at wordpress.com/triangulation. That's wordpress.com/triangulation. And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million people. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the smartest people in technology and pick their brains for an hour. It's a triangle because it's me and our guest and you. And we want to invite you to participate if you're watching live in our chat room at irc.twit.tv because your questions, your comments, your suggestions really help me do a better job. I think you're going to love our guest today. I've really been looking forward to this interview. Ali Al-Masawi is an alumnus of MIT's Engineering Systems Division and Carnegie Mellon's School of Computer Science. He's on the data science team at Mozilla. He worked as a research associate at Harvard. He's a collaborator at the MIT Media Lab. And you may have seen his previous book. In fact, if you haven't, you must go right now to bookofbadarguments.com, which is not only a beautiful book, but describes all of the, well, not all, but many of the bad rhetorical tricks that we're seeing so often these days in politics and in the world around us. And it's fantastic. It is really, really great. Ali, thank you so much for joining us today on Triangulation.
Oh, thank you.
I hope we're not keeping you from your daily walk to the Embarcadero.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. So I think I want to start a little bit with the book of bad arguments, because some people may know that, and if they don't, you've put it entirely online, which I think is fantastic. What was the prompt to get you to write this book?
It was really, I mean, when I think back to it, there is not much that's novel about that book. The only novel thing perhaps is the format. It's a subset of fallacies put in this particular format where you have a short exposition and then a funny sketch next to it. And it's available online for free. So I think the combination of those two things kind of made it different than what was already out there. And for the first month when I published it online, there wasn't much, I didn't get a lot of traction. And then all of a sudden, one of the websites, I think it was IO9, posted about it. And then there was much more interest in the project. And then from then on, you know, we've had a lot of translations, as you can see. Volunteers have given up their time to translate the project.
Look at all these languages. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah.
It's also on GitHub, so I think about 20 or plus people have suggested corrections and edits, and all those have made it into the book as well.
Yeah, here's a footnote. This illustration is inspired by a discussion on Usenet several years ago in which an overzealous and stubborn programmer was a participant. You can, you know, if you look up ad hominem on Wikipedia, you can get the description of ad hominem. But it's the simple description of it and the illustration. And I think if people haven't, I found this kind of eye-opening. It's because we often use these kind of unwittingly, and they're certainly used all the time in the public fora. And it's really kind of great to go, oh, yeah, that's a fallacy. That's not an appropriate argument. People do it all the time. And these, I have to agree, these illustrations really bring it to life. I love them. So you decided to do another book. And in fact, this is you just told me before the show began, the fourth iteration of your new book, Bad Choices. Tell me about Bad Choices.
Yeah, a month after so Bad Arguments was self-published to begin with, mm-hmm. and then I finally got a publisher in December of 2013. And a month later, so in January of 2014, I sent Alejandro, the illustrator, an email, and I said, do you want to know, try to do the same thing for another topic, and he was interested. So this other topic was computer science, and I was interested in seeing if we could do something similar, take an abstract concept in this case and make it more familiar and engaging to a broad audience. So the first attempt was to write a story, much like Alice's Adventures in Wonderland or any of Sophie's World, for instance, where you read a plot line and then you learn all these lessons as you go along. But that had limited success. And then I tried a second idea where I was formalizing the story space and then allowing people to contribute to these various components in the story space. The idea being that they could build their own personalized story that would have these lessons built into it. And then this final idea, Bad Choices, is a kind of a compromise between those two extremes. There are 12 chapters in the book where I lay out a scene in each chapter, and there's a character who wants to achieve some objective. And along the way, the reader learns what the multiple ways of achieving that objective are and how they compare relative to each other. So rather than explaining what binary search is, for instance, you learn about binary search within the context of all the other types of search algorithms that exist. So we're not too concerned with the steps involved in each of those algorithms, but rather how they fit into the wider world and how they work relative to each other.
Yeah, and this is more ambitious because bad arguments, I think everybody can kind of identify with, and frankly, bad arguments should probably be taught in every high school in the country. This is kind of fundamental learning. But when you come to algorithms, almost a new way of thinking for some people. And yet for people like you, I bet it's something that you've just always done automatically.
Yeah, that was the challenge with algorithms, because as you say, it's more abstract. And there were already quite a few projects out there that were attempting to do the same thing. If I remember correctly, I think all but a few either oversimplified the topic to the extent that it became vapid and not of interest, I think, to a large enough audience. Or they focused on things like syntax. So you ask yourself, what's the learning outcome if you're only learning about syntax or about a particular programming language? The only exception was one book that I found called Fabian and something else. I forget the title, but that was kind of what I was trying to do. It focused on learning outcomes, and then it thought about how can we frame this book or this story in a way that kind of achieves or maximizes those learning outcomes.
Yeah, because if you're a computer scientist, you learn this in college. I brought out my one of my volumes, volume one of Knuth, which is the class is called Fundamental Algorithms. And all it takes is about 5 minutes looking at this to realize there's a different kind of brain power involved with understanding how algorithms work. But you've done a really great job of, I think, making it a human scale in a way that people can understand. I think my brain does work that way, because I'll get in an elevator. And I'll say the algorithm in this elevator is wrong because it's not doing the optimal thing to get people from the 10th floor to the first floor. And you could see algorithms in life. And I don't know if everybody has that way of seeing things. I'll be doing things, like your first example, sorting socks. And I'll think there's got to be a better way to do this. Now, I am not as rigorous, however. And you've really spent some energy getting this right. But yet, to a computer scientist, I'm sure these are all just fairly obvious, right? Or not?
Yeah, that is. Part of the inspiration was that I've had the opportunity to work with different people who come from different kind of disciplines, and it's always interesting when you sit with a mathematician, for instance. His or her description of everything in life is from a mathematician's vantage. And so all the vocabulary they use, all the examples they have, all the concepts they appeal to is from that vantage. So I guess I try to do the same in this book, is thinking as a computer scientist, how would a computer scientist see the world? And the objective is to familiarize these concepts, not necessarily to say that we should always be efficient, but if we do care about efficiency, these are some ideas in computer science that are useful in computing, and maybe they're useful more generally as well. But just kind of making that connection, I think, is appealing.
Yeah, and I also think that a smart middle schooler or even sixth grader, and certainly any high schooler, might read this and go, "Oh, a light might go on. They might say, oh, a new way of thinking about things that they then fall in love with. And I think that's one reason that parents and teachers might want to look at Bad Choices as a book, just to have, you know, in the back of the classroom and the shelf. And just, you know, maybe a kid might stumble upon it and discover and go, oh. Because I tell you what, in the back you've got kind of a, you've got a breakdown. You start with fundamentals, stacks, arrays, worst average classes, linked lists, asymptotic notation. Then you go to searching, binary, linear, hash tables. Then you go to sorting, graphs, strings. You end with Huffman encoding. So this is some serious, real stuff. But there's no code in here at all. This is all conceptual.
It's all conceptual. That's right. Yeah. And absolutely. I think when I first... with this project as well as with the previous one, I started with an audience of kids in mind, because yeah. Kids always, you know, they don't hold back. They ask all kinds of questions. They really want to understand. Abstract doesn't work with kids, right? So, in all cases, that's the audience that I start with, and then eventually it kind of it might expand from then on.
Yeah, but what I like is in neither case do you treat the kid as a kid, like dumb. That you treat your reader as intelligent. And you don't, in any respect, talk down to them. In fact, it's quite funny. I got to read you the first sentence in the sock matching chapter. Baroness Margie Wanna is a member of a formerly influential Viennese family who was recently indicted for smuggling Kinder Surprise eggs into the United States. She now works as an au pair in Bern and is folding clothes for the first time. Now, anybody reading that is going to go, well, I got to find out what the hell this is about. It's fantastic. And, of course, you've got your illustrator, Alejandro Geraldo, has a lovely picture of Margie. Is it Vanna? I think it's Margie Wanna, because you make a joke about her name later on in the chapter, a couple of jokes.
Whatever makes the pun work.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's fun. And that's also a big part of this, is that you read that first sentence, you're going to keep going. And you're going to learn a little bit about sorting algorithms. And actually, this is more about arrays and how to go through arrays faster and faster. I feel like, you know, I learned a lot. I kind of understood it a little bit better. I think that's really, really cool. So let's talk. There's 12 algorithms in here. And all of them are tied to real things. Matching socks and shopping, you know, finding the, navigating the aisles. Actually, that's the last one. Is that Huffman encoding?
Huffman encoding, I think, is chapter 6 or 7. Might be 7.
Navigate the aisles is Wurzma Monet, a hedge fund manager who decided his extraordinary decision to become a rapper was brought about right after he gave a talk about credit default swaps to a class of 10-year-olds. and then again, Alejandro's great illustrations, and you actually this is great stuff. So what do you think was the this one looks pretty tough. What was the hardest algorithm to put into human terms for you?
I would say, since I'm dealing with fundamental algorithms in this book, I already had a subset of examples to begin with, because those examples were the reason why I thought this would work, why this particular format would work.
Oh, interesting.
So, the socks, the shirts on a rack, the graphs where you're navigating an area. It could be a supermarket, as is the case in the book. It could be something else. Prioritizing, tasks, or there's a clear tie-in there with real life as well. So I would say, maybe Huffman coding is quite a stretch, because the tie-in there is with Twitter, because with Twitter your space is constrained, and with Huffman coding you're also trying to optimize for space, so maybe that one is a bit of a stretch.
It's the chapter is Be More Hip, right? Is that right?
Be More Hip. Yeah, that's right.
Foy is a recent transplant to the fine city of Ashland. Despite his carefully maintained goatee, and there's Foy, and an insistence on always appearing in public with a months-old copy of The New Yorker tucked under one arm, a copy he's never read, mind you, but which he likes to nonchalantly pick up and toss down in front of him whenever he's at a cafe or restaurant, Foy remains an outsider in his new home. His go-to response to any open-ended question, Milton wouldn't be too happy, I can tell you that, is wearing thin.
Yeah, that's something I borrowed from Paul Betty's The Sellout, where there's a similarly named character who makes similar remarks. But yeah, that one's about link analysis, actually. Huffman coding is the next
link.
One.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. Okay.
Yeah. Link analysis, yeah, that one is probably maybe the most important chapter because of the effects of link analysis on technology today and the websites we use and recommendation engines and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of fun writing that chapter, and that whole scene is, it was a joy to put together.
Yeah, no kidding. Update that status. There it is. This is the Twitter one. Update that status. Yeah, how to encode your tweets to fit them into 140 characters. Awesome. We're talking to Ali Al-Mosawi. He is the author of a wonderful book called The Book of Bad Arguments, which you can see online. It's completely online for free, bookofbadarguments.com. And his newest is Bad Choices, How Algorithms Can Help You Think Smarter and Live Happier. And we will talk more with Ali in just a second. First, though, a word about living better through the web, through a great website called WordPress.com. You know about WordPress. I actually started my blogging with WordPress. I tried everything in the early 2000s, and I think it was 2003 I started hosting my own WordPress site, which you can do. But I've mentioned this before. I spent so much time kind of updating the site and fiddling with the code that I didn't actually blog that often. Now I'm at WordPress.com, and it's awesome. At first, I thought, no, I'm too much of a man to use WordPress.com. You know, oh, they're going to do the hosting? No. But, you know, first of all, I saved money because my server was costing a lot more than it costs to do WordPress.com. And they keep it up to date. They get the technology working. You always have the latest version of everything, including the plugins you use. And you're part of a larger community. So that's why I love WordPress.com. And really, it's no surprise, WordPress powers 28% of all websites, including some of the biggest press sites in the world. The WordPress VIP platform, if you Google that, quartz.com, for instance, a beautiful site, really sophisticated site running on WordPress. Time, TED, CNN, all run on WordPress. So if they can run on WordPress, you can run on WordPress, whether it's a blog, a personal blog, a business site, or both. You'll make a big impact when you build your website on WordPress.com, and it's fun. If you don't have any experience at all, don't worry. It's easy to do. You start with hundreds of templates. They have the best support ever, 24/7. And, of course, because WordPress is so widely used, there's a great community of experts who are glad to help you. With WordPress, you get built-in search engine optimization, built-in social sharing. Things like automatically you get HTTPS. It's just built in. If you want to use Google AMP to make your pages load faster on mobile, it's a checkbox. It's a simple thing to do. More websites run on WordPress than any other platform for good reason. Get started today. We've got a great deal for you. When you go to wordpress.com/triangulation, 15% off any new plan purchase. 15% off. wordpress.com/triangulation. And they've got a whole bunch of different prices to make it affordable and easy. It's not expensive. Like I said, it's a lot cheaper than I was just having my own server. WordPress and a lot more fun.com. I blog more because of it. WordPress.com/triangulation. Ali Al-Mosawi is our guest, author of Bad Arguments. You work at Mozilla still?
No, I was at Mozilla until earlier this year, but I was there for about 5 years working on the data science team.
Have you become a full-time author now?
Maybe one day.
Someday, is that a dream? What are you doing these days?
I still work at a tech company and tried whenever I have free time to work on side projects. So maybe another book in a few years' time. We'll see.
Good. We really like having you. These books are unique from the point of view. You said there are other books like this, but I have to say this. This feels so approachable and easy, and I think it really is unique. And I think, you know, a lot of times I get people asking, you know, I had somebody on a Sunday on the radio show say, I have an 8-year-old niece. She went to code camp, and she loves it. What should we do next? And I probably made a mistake because I said, oh, you know, go to Alice.org or Scratch.org and download Alice or Scratch, and she can use that, or on iPad there's Tinker. And I think maybe you start with something more like this, something that is not diving into code, not building something, but understanding kind of the ideas behind the scenes of algorithms and so forth. Have you played, do you have kids or nieces and nephews that you've played with this with?
Yeah, I have a daughter, a five-year-old daughter.
Oh, she's a little young for this.
But I actually tried the sock example with her. You know, I asked her, if we have a pile of socks, how would you go about matching the various pairs in this pile? And it was a nice conversation. You know, she went, yeah, I pick out a sock and then I look for its pair, and then I pick out another sock and look for its pair. And that's one of the less efficient option,
right?
Or alternative.
It's
that
the
I
obvious admit. First choice.
Yeah, so it's interesting then to have the conversation with a kid and say, well, there's this other way of doing the same thing. And I've received emails from a couple of, or maybe a few readers who have had similar conversations with their kids. And I think that's kind of the point here, is to make sure it's interactive and to not focus too much on what's right and what's wrong, but rather to see if we can start a conversation with each of these 12 chapters. And learn either the concepts that I'm pushing in the various chapters, or maybe learn about other concepts. One of the things I mentioned in the introduction is that, you know, when you go to a science museum, to the Exploratorium, for instance, you see parents all the time. They go up to an installation, they read a, you know, a description, and then they try to explain how the thing works to their kid. And if you listen closely, it's interesting how, you know, different parents explain things in different ways, and different kids walk away learning different things, but it's all valuable in the end, even though, you know, it's not consistent between them.
I do like the idea of asking first. Well, what do you think this does? How do you think this works? Go ahead and play with it. See what happens. And I think you take that. It's so much fun. You take that kind of approach. Like with the match the socks, you start with the obvious method, which probably a lot of people still do. You look for a sock, go through the pile, try to find a match, and then you take it out. Or maybe you throw it back in. And it's a ponderous process, but it's but then you describe a simpler way of doing it, which is to take a sock. If you've seen it before, you match it with the one you've seen before. Otherwise, you put it in a line. And actually, probably most people have come up with this, and then you match, and then you match, and you get even a little bit more sophisticated because you end up talking about dictionaries and hash tables. But you get there in a way that I think is accessible. I think it's understandable, which is great.
Absolutely, yeah. And I actually encourage readers, if they have if they have comments about these various examples, if they have better examples, to get in touch, because that's how this kind of thing improves and develops. So I'm always looking for more examples and improvements on existing examples, and I've gotten a few, and they're always fun to engage with and read.
You also have a few inside it. Jokes for computer scientists. When you mention the hash table, you say, more salt in the wound for poor Margie. So if you're reading along and you kind of know what this is about, it's fun. It really is fun, I have to say. Let's see. Find your size. This is chapter 2. I love the stories you tell. It's the day after Christmas. I presume that these are how the novella started, with these stories.
To an extent, yeah.
It's the day after Christmas, and Epitome, a nurse from Inverness, has started camping outside of a department store in preparation for this year's Boxing Day sale. Her shirt size is quite common. She wants to make sure she's the first one into the store so she can grab all the shirts that are in her size. She's going to have to be fast. Things get pretty ugly. Last year, 15 people were injured and the army had to intervene. How might Epi, and here's the question, increase her odds of grabbing the shirt she's after before everyone else? And then you say, hint, consider pushing the example to an absurd limit. What if the racks were as wide as the store? So now we're talking about search algorithms. And you even, I think this is brave of you, introduce the idea of a graph showing different algorithms, faster, slower, fewer things to do, lots of things to do, and how to optimize. But I think it works. It's a lot easier than Knuth, let's put it that way. Does she learn some sorts? She's doing a binary search at some point.
Yeah, so it's the tie-in is a simple example, binary search versus linear search. But I think the point about the graph is critical because what I try to do in these chapters is to use approximations. And one of these approximations is rates of growth. So can we abstract these algorithms and talk about them in terms of rates of growth? And that's what these graphs that you find are attempting to do. And I think I've not seen that done before for this particular audience. And I think it's useful to appeal to these approximations. So another approximation is orders of magnitude that you find in the book, just talking about how things compare in terms of orders of magnitude. But you do give up something. So with Knuth, for instance, you have ultimate rigor, right?
Right.
With this, you don't have a lot of rigor, but hopefully you get something else in return. Maybe familiarity, maybe it's more engaging, maybe it's more accessible to people. So I think all these projects, they work together, and try to achieve the same thing, but maybe for different audiences.
It's kind of like think like a computer scientist, but in a subtle way. Did you, in the process of doing this yourself, feel like you got some insights into these processes, or is this just so obvious to you that this is baby steps?
Oh, absolutely. Once I started thinking of examples, then only then did I start seeing them in real life. So I'd get on an elevator and I'd say, well, how does the kind of the dispatch system, kind of say elevator? I have a pile of clothes that I take out of the dryer, and I start thinking about, well, how can this be turned into an example? And for me, it was, like I said, I started this project 3 years ago, and I spent at least several months, if not more, just thinking about examples and more examples, and it was great. I learned a lot for sure.
Neat. I'd love to see more books kind of like this, that instead of diving into code, talk in a human scale in prose about concepts. I think this is really, it's a really important start in getting people to think about algorithms. Are you thinking, I mean, Knuth is still writing 50 years later. Are you thinking there might be a series after this where you get a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more deeper into the subject?
I think where I can provide value is with this initial step.
Yeah.
So thinking about what's the broadest audience, what is an interesting field of study, and how can I connect the two together?
Yeah.
Writers like Knuth and many others, they're focused on the other end of the spectrum. And I don't know if I'd be able to provide much value at that end.
No, and I wouldn't expect you to, but I think it would be nice to do more, like a volume with more algorithms, maybe get to more sorts and, you know, different things like that.
Possibly, yeah, absolutely. I was thinking of the same even for Bad Arguments. We had a few ideas, myself and some of the volunteers, about extending that project and maybe having a kids version where it's in rhyming verse and we have
single
story.
Yeah.
Maybe we focus on a few of the fallacies. And there were a few other ideas going around as well. So I might pursue that. We'll see.
You could even do, I would think logic would be fun. It's kind of kind of related to the Book of Bad Arguments. There's a lot of areas that could really benefit, with this treatment. We're talking to Ali Al-Mosawi. His book is Bad Choices. Follows up on his previous book, Bad Arguments, the Book of Bad Arguments. If you want to get a sense of his sense of humor and his talent and his great illustrator, Alejandro Geraldo, go to bookofbadarguments.com. He's Creative Commons, the book, and you can read it all there. You decided not to do that with Bad Choices, I take it. Viking probably had another idea.
We'll see what happens with that. It's something that I hope will happen. With Bad Arguments, part of the project was getting it out there and providing it for free under a Creative Commons license helped with that. With big publishers, it's a bit more difficult to win these battles with them, but it's still one that I'd like to pursue and see if there's something we can do about it. So far, only the first chapter is available online. If you look at the GitHub repo, we can find it there. But we'll see if we can change that. I definitely see a tremendous value in providing content like this for free.
You bet. Plus, the feedback you get from readers certainly makes a difference in Bad Arguments. and all the translations and so forth. People want to get involved in something like this. I think it's very approachable. It's exciting.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. With bad arguments, there were some obvious mistakes in it that readers pointed out in the first few weeks. And when I think about like how much time and effort it takes to translate a project, and then to update the illustrations and to proofread it and all that, it's a tremendous amount of time. And you can only get that level of engagement from readers when the author also has kind of shares that spirit and wants the thing to be available for all.
You bet. We'll have more with Ali and his book, Bad Choices, in just a second. But I have to make a choice right now to talk about FreshBooks.com, our sponsor today. FreshBooks saved my life when I was a lowly freelancer about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, and going to Canada 1 week a month to do the TV show up there. And gosh, I'd have to invoice them to get paid, right? And I'd have to invoice them for expenses. And it was such a pain going through all the receipts and all of that stuff. I just put it off. And then I found out kind of a vital lesson. It's not worth a book, but I think it's an important lesson. If you don't invoice, you don't get paid. So 6 months down the road, when I hadn't received any payments, I finally sent them all the invoices, and they got mad. They said, you can't do this. You have to do this regularly. That's when Amber MacArthur told me about FreshBooks. It was a startup in Toronto around 2004. Brand new company. In fact, I remember it was, Web 2.0. Ooh. Well, they've come a long way. Now 10 million people use FreshBooks, and it's gotten better and better. Yes, you still can use it to do the invoices. In fact, that's where it all begins. This is what's cool about this is it's accounting without you doing any accounting. It's just in the process of sending out invoices, tracking expenses, tracking receipts, tracking billable hours by project, by company. You get all the information that you need. Then on the dashboard in FreshBooks, you find out things. I think a lot of freelancers, I know this was true of me, wouldn't know till tax time, maybe not even then, if they'd made any money that year. Are you profitable? Shouldn't you know that every step of the way? Well, with FreshBooks, you know it's right on the front page, profit and loss, automatically, how much it cost you to make how much money, all of those things. And, of course, when it comes time for taxes, they produce the reports that these darn accountants and bookkeepers want, things like sales tax summaries and profit and loss statements. So your taxes are easier to do. The time tracking feature, this is new, makes it easy to bill for time by client and by projects. You just press play to track your time to the minute. And when it comes time to create the invoice, you'll know what you did and when. And the invoices look great. They have your company logo on it. It does currency conversions. I had to convert to Canadian dollars. That was always a pain. This does it automatically to all different currencies. There's even, in the invoice, a way for your client to pay you. And that's kind of great because it turns out clients paying bills, you know this probably from your own life, paying bills is just as painful as sending the bills. It's one of those things you want to put off. If you make it easy for your clients to pay you, they will pay you faster. In fact, on average, FreshBooks users get paid 11 days faster because your customer can pay straight from your invoice. You'll know what invoices have been sent, what invoices have been paid, what invoices have not been paid. They can automatically send out reminders, late payment reminders, automatic payment reminders. You can even set automatic late fees. You'll even know when the invoices were read. So no more of that, I didn't get your invoice. That excuse isn't going to work anymore. Snap photos of your receipts. Connect your bank account or your credit card, automatically import expenses daily. The app is great for Android and iOS. That can also do the time, keeping and the expenses. And, of course, it integrates with everything you're already using. So you can use Stripe if you want, or Shopify, or Gusto, or Acuity Scheduling, whatever it is. New features are being added all the time. And that's another reason to love FreshBooks. For instance, you can now create and send estimates to your clients from the iOS app. You can send invoices to multiple people in an organization. Add them as secondary contacts. You get a detailed overview of client payments with a new payments collected report. They were in the Forbes list of small giants for 2017. FreshBooks.com, no surprise. If you go right now to FreshBooks.com/triangulation and tell them you heard about it on Triangulation, you'll get it free for 30 days. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. I owe them a great debt. They saved my keister when I was working all by myself. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. Ali Al-Masawi is here. He's the author of Bad Choices, How Algorithms Can Help You Think Smarter and Live Happier. I think I have a little I think in some ways it's a failing efficiency expert in my brain, because I often look at stuff and say, well, that's inefficient. That's not being done right. I could do that better. That's kind of algorithmic thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. If that's the one quality that that the various chapters in the book focus on, is efficiency. So if you want to optimize for efficiency, then how should you be thinking about these various tasks that you do?
And you don't have to be efficient all the time either. You're not arguing for efficiency, just saying here's how you would do it.
Not at all. In fact, there are things that where efficiency does, you know, as a quality, does not make sense. So, for instance, I gave this example recently. I like to walk a lot in the city. It helps me recharge. And when I'm walking throughout the city, I never think about the most efficient path that I ought to take, right? Because it's not relevant to my to what I'm trying to optimize for. And there are other things in life where efficiency is not at all important. But when it is important, then it's, I think, useful to know what are the things that we should be considering.
Yeah, how we can optimize. As a computer scientist, as a person working actively in the field, do you discover and invent new algorithms, or have all the algorithms, is it all in Knuth? Is it all done? Are we done?
Probably not. If you look at fields that are still not fully formed, like machine learning, for instance, you find all kinds of new ways being developed for optimizing various things. So wherever there is work left to do, then you find more innovations in the form of algorithms and other ways of thinking.
How do you have a method in your work? Because you're a data scientist, so that means you are dealing with these kinds of new fields. Or do you have a method for solving a problem, looking at a problem and coming up with an algorithm?
I can't say that I've had I've been presented with an opportunity to do that so far. Usually the work that I do is fairly constrained in scope. So I work with a data scientist and then think about how can I take the work of data scientists and turn it into something, be it graphics or something else, that's compelling for a certain type of audience.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Within that limited scope, there's a lot of space to do creative things innovate, but not in the way of developing algorithms, but probably in other ways. So graphically, how can we think about various encodings of data and so on?
That's actually got to be harder, because algorithms, it's math, it's testable, it's provable. But communicating concepts to humans is very difficult to do. And we're kind of squishy, not mathematical. Not all, as we learn from bad arguments, often not very logical.
Yeah, there are these concepts that we sometimes think in terms of, they might come from psychology, maybe not, about how do people perceive things? What are the qualities that we ought to care about if we want to highlight certain things in something that's being presented to someone? So how can we best use color? How can we best use proximity of various elements?
Interesting.
Annotations, those kinds of things. So there's a lot of opportunity to think of how best to communicate something to someone within the field of data visualization.
I think of Edward Tufte, of course, who was a computer scientist, but also the genius in visualization, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. He's done so much work, and he's kind of the Donald Knuth of data visualization, I would say, right? Maybe that's something for you to start working on, Ali. So a book on how to visualize and express complex topics graphically.
Possibly. These projects so far have been escapes from my primary.
Yeah, you don't want to do your work at home too. Do you think about your 5-year-old when you write these? Like maybe she'll, in 10 years she'll be looking for a book like this.
Yeah, absolutely. In both cases that's been the case. Yeah. With the first one and then with the second one, and perhaps even with future ones. Having a kid allows you to have a concrete audience, because you can imagine the kinds of questions they would ask.
Right.
How they think about things, what intrigues them, what they're curious about. I think that's been helpful for me so far.
Yeah, I found once I had children, it changed a lot of how I thought about life. And you do, it really does change your focuses, and you do start thinking about the world from, through their eyes a little bit.
Yeah.
And make life a little bit easier for them down the road. Well, you've really done it. I think everybody, every Every high school kid, at least. You know, if I get the feeling you studied debate in school. Did you do forensics?
I didn't. I mean, informally, I did, not as a class, but I was very interested in college and debate. And we had these debating clubs and other kinds of clubs where there was opportunity to debate. And yeah, I spent most of my college and high school years doing that. And that was a formative experience, because when you debate a topic with someone, especially with passionate people, then you kind of identify the flaws in your and their thinking, and also in what makes the convincing argument. So those years were quite formative.
Yeah, I bet. That's where I think a lot of people who already know about these fallacies learn them, because you're taught that kind of formally when you do forensics. You're taught, had to avoid them in most cases, and how to pinpoint them in your opponent's arguments so that you can say, well, I my friend, that is a straw man fallacy. But so that's interesting that you didn't do it formally, but this, I would say every debate club should have this on their bookshelf, bad arguments on their bookshelf, and every computer science class and logic class, and just any time when you want to think more rigorously should have bad choices on the bookshelf. Because it's not really, I don't know if algorithms is really describes it thoroughly. It's a way of thinking about stuff that is very useful. As you say, it's not universally applicable, but when it is time to do something efficiently. So, yes, so for instance, walking, I agree with you. Walking should be aimless, but I often am spending time, and it drives my wife crazy. I say, well, no, we need to cut across this street diagonally to save steps. And it drives her nuts. She says, we're just taking a walk here. So it can be a bad habit, too. Ali, it was a pleasure meeting you, and I want to thank you for both books. Really great, highly recommended, and encourage you to write more, because I think you have a real talent for this.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bad Choices, How Algorithms Can Help You Think Smarter and Live Happier, Ali Al-Mosawi, the author of Bad Arguments. You can get this everywhere. Of course, Amazon.com, and I highly recommend it. And as I said, I think a smart middle schooler would read it with interest. Certainly a high schooler who has some interest in computer science or logic or math. It's available on Kindle as well. So get it, Bad Choices. Thank you, Ali.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Okay.
We do triangulation every Monday. Actually, we do it different times sometimes, but generally Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. If you want to join us and be part of the triangle, the third leg of the stool, if you will, just tune in then at twit.tv/live, and then fire up your browser and go to irc.twit.tv. Or if you're an old-timer, you can use your IRC client and join us in there for your feedback and questions and comments, which are very helpful to me. We're changing a little bit the way we do triangulation. That's one of the reasons the times shift from time to time. We have always had noted that some of our guests can't make it at this particular time, so we'll record at other times. But we're also I'm trying to give up a little bit of the triangulation time to my colleagues. So Megan Maroney and Jason Howell are doing interviews on triangulation, bringing in guests they're interested in. You'll see a lot of them. And from time to time, we'll, as we did last Monday, we'll do a double header where Megan will do one at 9 a.m. Pacific and I'll do one at 11 a.m. Pacific. So check our calendar, twit.tv/cal, to see what the production schedule is if you like to watch live. Of course, you don't have to watch live because we have a feed, an RSS feed, that that's how podcasts work, that allow you to subscribe and get every episode the minute it's available on your phone, so you can, or your dare I say iPod, so you can listen at your leisure. Just go to twit.tv/TRI for all of our shows. You can download them directly or subscribe in your favorite podcatcher, and that way you won't miss any of the episodes. You won't have to worry about the schedule. You'll just get them automatically. And for those of you listening on airplanes, I know many of you are, thank you for being here, and I hope you will seek us out at twit.tv/TRI. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks to Karsten Bondi, our producer, Tanya Hall, who helps with booking. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.